Hey everyone, welcome back to the Monday edition of the Goody Reader Radio Show. My name is Michael and I'm joined today by Mercy Pilkington. Mercy, how's it going?
Going great.
So as you know, I attended the American Library Association annual event in Las Vegas, and this was the first time I've ever gone to Vegas while it has been ridiculously hot in the summertime. So in Celsius, it was about like 40 to about 45 C, which I think is about close to about 100 Fahrenheit. Does that sound right?
Sounds about right. People are somewhere in the ballpark of what, 30? Is it right? What's a normal Celsius temperature for a human? Because that's not it.
You know, you walked outside and it was like you're blasted by like a furnace. So I kind of understand how blacksmiths must have felt sitting outside of like the forge every day forever.
Exactly.
So there was a few trends and I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
Okay.
One of them was libraries as retail. And I guess as we kind of know, Simon & Schuster mandated that if libraries or consortiums, groups of libraries that band together to do group purchases, if they want to have Simon & Schuster titles available to their patrons, they have to sell them online. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I'm not in favor of anything that requires a library to alter its mode of existence in order to stay in business. It's all well and good to encourage, to offer some kind of incentive, some kickback, whatever. We actually have great documented information now coming out of sources like Kobo over the last several years, and Overdrive and Sourcebooks, that have showed us how libraries actually affect book sales. So it'd be great to see that work in reverse. If libraries are causing their patrons to go purchase books, largely due to the fact that either the checkout period was ending and the person didn't finish, so they just went and bought the book, or we're also seeing people who don't want to wait for the sequel. So they read book one in the series and they know their library is not going to have it for a while, so they just go ahead and buy book two. And so we know that libraries are affecting book sales in a positive way, but I can't get behind anything that says you're not going to have our titles. Could you clarify for me, because I'm not really sure about this, was there a minimum requirement or was it simply you will make our books available for sale? Are libraries expected to produce numbers?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to a lot of librarians, I guess, at AILA, and a lot of them were not very happy about, a lot of them were just saying that, you know, we're abusing the public trust, we're having to basically be bookstores now. And with consortiums, a lot of people don't know, and I kind of broke the story today, was that all members of the consortia have to agree to carry and sell Simon & Schuster titles. So if you belong to one of the larger ones that, you know, between 200 and 600 libraries belong to it, if, you know, 10 libraries say we don't want to have Simon & Schuster titles, how crazy of a job is the collections manager who's responsible for buying the titles and distributing them to libraries? It's like, okay, we can distribute here, here, but not here and not there. And imagine being the poor, you know, intern or, you know, the new librarian whose job is to call all 600 consortia libraries and try to convince them to act as retail. I do not, you know, that call, all those calls must be crazy.
Right. And I'm very worried also about the stocking of titles. If they're carrying these titles, whether they're print or ebook, I guess I'm tempted to say it's one thing to put a corner of your website that is a click through to purchasing a title. But where does it stop? I mean, how many publishers in the world can now go, oh, well, you sell Simon & Schuster, you're not getting my titles unless you stop it, or unless you give mine more shelf space? It's going to turn into a Barnes & Noble nightmare where publishers have to contract with for the display space, and we've already actually seen that fall through with Simon & Schuster, where Barnes & Noble refused to carry those titles for a while because they couldn't work out their agreements on how much display space Simon & Schuster was going to take in the store. And now we're going to bring this onto librarians who are lucky to be putting food on their tables as it is. And they're, like you said, they're not retailers.
So the other major trend of the American Library Association was pay per use. And what we've seen in the past is in libraries, if you want to buy ebooks, audiobooks, video, music, academic, whatever, you have to buy that stuff in advance and then offer it to the users. And that's the way it's always been. You know, when you walk into the physical library, those books are there because the collection managers bought them in advance, understanding the needs of the community. Pay-per-click is a new phenomenon that's starting to catch on with videos and audiobooks right now, where they can offer the entire collection that a publisher has, and the library only pays if someone actually checks it out. This is a kind of a cool method. Hoopla, who you've talked to before, they're doing it with audiobooks, and Overdrive is doing it with Warner Brothers movies in a new contract that they just signed. So I think that there's something very interesting about this, where instead of, you know, selectively saying, okay, maybe I'll get this or maybe I'll get that, you could just say, blah, you know, here's everything, and we'll kind of curate it with like maybe seasonal themes, or, you know, because like if you have like 50,000 titles, I mean, that's kind of overwhelming. But if you curate it properly and if you have a bit of a editorial oversight, you could make it work. What do you think about this kind of the future of library digital?
What I really loved about my conversation with Hoopla, which was at Book Expo this year, and a little follow-up interview afterward, is what kept running through my mind was what a godsend this is going to be for your small libraries, the ones who are not in a giant multi-library consortium, for example, who are just standalone, struggling to get by, trying to demonstrate to their city governments that they need budget in the first place. And basically, one of the big disappointments in ebook lending has been all these libraries who've signed up with Overdrive or 3M or someone and still don't have titles, because it's not Overdrive's fault that the library couldn't purchase a large enough catalog. Overdrive works the way it does. 3M, the same thing. And so there are libraries and consortium who can buy the whole content catalog from Overdrive. And then there are small ones who get, you know, last year's cast-offs and, you know, three publishers' backlists. I waited for at least 5 weeks for one of the two copies of American Gods from my local library
to get the chance.
Exactly.
That's an awesome book.
It is, but it's not a new book. It's kind of a mid-list right now. I mean, it's not his newest stuff. And our library had two copies of the ebook. I waited for 5 weeks to get it, for the opportunity to look at it for 10 days, and then it was going to disappear off my device. And so in the meantime, as I'm, you know, basically compiling this massive list of things I would like to read someday when other people give them back, I'm thinking, why do ebooks work this way? This is stupid. I'm waiting for the right to look at a file on a computer. And so the whole time I was talking to Hoopla, I thought, you know, this is really smart. My only concern, and I didn't get a really clear picture of how Hoopla addresses it, I did come away confident that they know how they address it, is what stops the patronage of a small library from jacking up the bill. They indicated that there are warning emails and that there's threshold limits and stuff like that. But basically, if your entire town checks out everything in your limit by the 13th of the month, we all get to wait until the 1st of next month. I'm certain that can't be the only method that it works. But otherwise, I was just really afraid of libraries coming away with a large, unexpected bill at the end of it. And since they say there are safeguards in place to prevent that from happening to libraries, I think it's an awesome idea. There's no more curating, no more picking and choosing and what can we afford and things like that, because you're not going to pay anything except for what you can actually convince patrons to use. And as we know, when patrons use the library, that has a positive impact on your budget for next year.
Yeah, I know with Hoopla, they have daily, weekly, and monthly spending limits. And if you go beyond that limit, it says, you know, all audiobooks have been checked out. Please check back tomorrow or something like that. Right. And then that way a library could maintain its budget a little bit more effectively. And I do also know with Hoopla that they don't charge libraries any like usage fees. So if you want to incorporate the Hoopla audiobook system in your library, you don't have to pay any fees to do that. You're just basically paying like the fees when someone checks something out.
Right.
180, you, Mercy, you're a writer. You know, you've written a lot of books. And
yes.
one Hugh Howey, who we're both quite familiar with, he is calling on an authors union, and we already kind of have authors unions, Science Fiction Writers of America, the romance writers, you know, there's a lot of ones out there. What's so different with like Hugh's rallying cry this time?
Right. I only saw the access to this today. And so I'm really intrigued to sit down with a cup of coffee tonight, or I'm sorry, let's face it, a glass of wine tonight, and read this whole article on writers unions. There are, of course, varying opinions on this, but what I can say in all honesty and all confidence is there is no organization right now that can actually speak for indie authors. There are lots of organizations that have been set up to pretend to represent them. Authors Guild, for example, represents authors. Indie authors can't even get in, can't even pay the membership fee unless they can prove a minimum threshold of sales within an 18-month period. So there's a lot of hoop jumping to get in. There are even Romance Writers of America. My understanding from Romance Writers is, again, they have to have a minimum threshold of sales in order to get in. So, again, that's a retail organization. That is not a writer's organization. Basically, the day I put pen to paper or finger to keyboard, that was the day I became a writer. The day I sold books is the day I became a businesswoman and I retailed my product. So again, we don't really have anybody who's saying we are speaking for authors. I noticed in the beginning of Hugh's post, that was his chief complaint. He is a member of the Science Fiction Writers of America, and they issued their open letter claiming their support for Hachette in the ongoing dispute against Amazon. And Hugh Howey has been one of the most vocal people supporting Amazon in this whole battle. And so obviously they don't speak for him. And as he points out, they did that without consulting the membership. Basically, the leadership got together and for whatever reason decided that they don't agree with Amazon in this situation. And again, without much to back it up. So I think the term union, though, it indicates that there's some kind of power and some kind of clout. So basically, if there is a union of indie authors, how do you get in? How much do you pay to be a part of it? And what can they actually do for you? So if Amazon somehow tomorrow turned on the indie authors and said, we're taking 80% royalty or some such thing, what are the authors going to do about it? And what is some members-only club going to really effectively do? Since even Hachette can't fight Amazon on this one. So it'll be interesting to see developments and people's responses to this. Without more information, I don't see it being any kind of really, really feasible, powerful group. It would be nice to be a group of people who have like-minded support for each other.
Mercy, you do a lot of traveling. You're mm-hmm. often in New York and gallivanting across the world, going to various publishing events, London, Frankfurt, and so on. Now, obviously, you're familiar with customs, and you know mm-hmm. when you're going through customs, you have to take your laptop out, you have to take your phone out, and things like that. And if you travel with an e-reader or a tablet, often that has to come out too. Now, there's mm-hmm. actually a very interesting event occurring with the TSA, where they're saying that if you travel with an e-reader, if you travel with a tablet or a phone, those have to be on. And if they're not on and you prove that they could work, then they won't allow you to bring it on the flight. And this is due to, I guess, out of Syria and Yemen, there's intelligence saying that they're basically filling phones up with explosives and they want to take down flights. And apparently those, you know, those bomb phones, as it were, they don't turn on. So
right.
You have to make sure now that if you're traveling, that everything's turned on and everything's well-powered, because if your phone were to suddenly die as you're standing in a two-hour line, you're right. going to go to secondary screening, and chances are you're going to miss your flight.
Right. Yeah, I would love to say it's overkill and it's ridiculous, because on the surface it sounds like it. But the TSA does have a bad history, unfortunately. Excuse me, I'm sorry. The FAA has a bad history of making sweeping mandates concerning devices without really anything to back it up. And so this was actually what one congresswoman was actually fighting in the whole ban on devices during takeoff and landing, which, as we know, has now changed. You can now have your devices the entire flight, as long as they're in airplane mode or not Wi-Fi enabled. And so that was her point the whole time is, you know, I'm willing to turn off my device. Just prove it. Prove that this is a problem. And I want to say the same thing. I would love to say, you know, show me some numbers, show me some intelligence you've gotten that we're filling bombs and Kindles phones and Kindles with explosives. But at the same time, it's also logical. And I think it's the stuff of imagination. It's the stuff of movies, you know?
Yeah.
And so as criminals get more sophisticated, I would love to say it's overkill, but at the same time, the first time a plane blows up, we're going to say, where was the TSA? You know, so it's an annoyance. Yeah. It's part of airline travel, I guess. I'm happier that they're recognizing that our devices are not evil and going to take down a flying airplane. If it was that simple to bring a plane out of the sky with my iPhone, I'd be really upset.
Or the Kindle.
Exactly, my Kindle. My cookbook recipes are going to bring up this flight. You know, my trashy romance novel is going to bring this plane out of the sky. You know, so I'm glad that we're getting some more common sense about devices and understanding how they do and do not work. But, you know, who would have thought about bodies coming across borders filled with drugs? I mean, it's one of those who would have thought scenarios, I guess.
Totally. So I've been kind of vocal lately about how Kobo and Barnes & Noble should abandon their self-publishing programs.
Mainly, you?
Yeah. No. Me being negative and critical?
Really? No.
The thought. My kind of argument was that, you know, the more people that start publishing with Barnes & Noble and Kobo, the more people that are eventually going to switch to Amazon because they just offer you better exclusive terms to go with them. I mean, Amazon's the only company that gives you money if someone borrows your book for free.
Right.
You know, and I've been really critical about their footprints. They don't really have a lot of market penetration. I talk to a lot of authors, and you know, for every 10 books they sell on Amazon, they might sell like one or two on Kobo and one or two on Barnes and Noble. So those numbers are you know, I've talked to like lots, you know, like over 100 over the years at various conventions, and that seems to be like the trend. But apparently Barnes & Noble has a Nook Press blog that they're, you know, they've been running for a little while, but they've started to really update it a lot with content lately.
Right. They started the blog back in February, and they do a lot with guest authors. They really seem to have a stronger presence on their Facebook page and their social media channels. So when I actually asked Julia Koblenz, who's one of their senior marketing experts over Nook Press, specifically the publishing platform, I said, well, where is all the interaction taking place? There's not a lot of comments on the blog. She said, it really is about the Facebook. And so that's where these Facebook chats are happening and authors are congregating and readers are congregating and talking. They do also get a good bit of traction from well-known authors coming over their Facebook. And I think, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, I get the impression that a lot of people feel like we need Nook and Kobo and all these other platforms just because the world's a better place when you have more options to buy a book. And as much as I adore Amazon, everybody knows I'm the big Amazon champion, it's not a good world when you have one option because, first of all, anything could happen to that one company. And so it's always a good idea to have more options. And I like the response from authors who are throwing some of that support to Barnes & Noble, to their blog through guest posts or to their Facebook chats and things like that. What I would really appreciate seeing is we keep hearing, you know, how do we take down Amazon? How do we compete with Amazon? And we hear that from publishers and retailers and organizations. It would be so nice if people stopped saying that and stopped saying, how do we compete with them, and stop competing. Do something else. Kobo has an incredible international presence, and it's appalling that authors and readers don't know that they're in 190 countries. Is that the latest number? Because that's been true for a year now. I mean, basically, if you have any book with any kind of international theme, if your character so much as changes planes in Portugal, okay, why aren't you capitalizing on the Kobo experience and reaching international readers when so much of the world also speaks and reads English? at the same time, Barnes & Noble does a really great job of running a really pretty and really pleasant bookstore. Why aren't you letting indie authors in their bookstores in print? And I asked that question in Frankfurt in an interview with one of the vice presidents and said, you can stop this Amazon exclusivity crap today. If you just said, you've got to take your book out of exclusive, you got to take it out of select, and we will pick this many titles a month and give you 1 month in our Barnes & Noble stores. It might even just be the 5 stores closest to your house, geographically, but we'll do it. And they won't do it. Well, I'm sorry. If you're going to keep trying to replicate the Amazon experience, good luck.
And that seems to be what a lot of startups try to do, where they try to be Amazon-lite, and it never really works because they never really are distinctive enough in the marketplace. I mean, let's face it. I mean, if you want to self-publish, there's no shortage of companies that will self-publish you for either a fee or, you know, will do it for free, and they'll just take a percentage of every single sale. You've been doing book reviews, Mercy, on Goody Reader for years, and I've never really seen you give 5 stars to a book, but you gave it to The Silkworm.
I did. I was pleasantly surprised. And I have to say that, you know, when you get 5 stars from me, first of all, it does mean something. But if you get 5 stars for a mystery or a thriller, something like that, that's not my preferred genre. And it was funny, I was actually just talking to someone today about my trashing, unfortunately, of Stephen King's latest novel. I don't enjoy thrillers, and I don't enjoy Stephen King in particular. And I had to suspend that, knowing that readers wanted to know about Mr. Mercedes. And I think the same thing is true for The Silkworm. People care about this book and other opinions on it. And so I had to suspend the fact that it's not my preferred reading material, you know, if I'm just sitting down with a book. And so it really does matter that, you know, she got 5 stars from me for that. I will say her first adult title, Casual Vacancy, was the first 2-star review that Goody Reader ever gave. So up until then, it had been sunshine and roses until that book came along, and I despised it. It was difficult. I mean, I had to slog my way through it, knowing from page 2 how I was going to rate that book, because it was just that bad. But I pointed out that, you know, kudos to her for writing the book she wanted to write. She could have easily caved to what the public would have expected, and she didn't, you know, so God love her for that. But anyway, The Silkworm, I think she went right back to her original talent, which is world building. Rowling has always been awesome at putting you in the setting, and it doesn't matter where it is. I mean, I can fully envision every aspect of Harry Potter. I can see that school. I can see his house under the, you know, this room under the stairs, because she's really great at putting you in the book. And she does the same thing with the Cormoran Strike books.
Mercy, you have kids?
I do.
And do you find it challenging during the summertime to get them to read?
Absolutely.
So we recently did a post about, you know, things that parents could do to get their kids reading, because, you know, it's surprising. The American Time Use Survey came out about 2 weeks ago, and they said ages, like teenagers 15 to 19, only read 4 minutes a day, and most kids, 14 to about, you know, 6 or so, the only books they read are part of the books they read at school, you know, so right. Remedial reading for English class and things like that. So when I originally wrote about that, I, you know, had about 100 parents write in and say, you know, this is deplorable. Why aren't the schools doing anything? Why isn't this? And I'm like, you know, it's the parents' responsibility first and foremost to foster the love of reading. You know, a lot of kids, they learn from what their parents do. So if their parents aren't reading and their parents are always watching TV, that's mainly what the kids are going to do. But if there's like books and magazines all over the house and new things and, you know, a family trip to the library, the bookstore, chances are the kids are going to read a little bit more. So we put together a little bit of a post on things that you know, parents could do, or apps they could install on their smartphones or tablets to get them reading. And a few of the apps that I'll quickly just mention is Scholastic Storia, which is, you know, they give you thousands of books, four free ebooks from starting from just starting up an account. And it harkens back to the day, and I don't know if you had this, Mercy, where you lived, but the Scholastic Book Fairs.
We do, and those are always really popular among students. I love to see those come back. And I do like the steps, not strides, but steps that Scholastic has taken in digitizing their book fairs. They're getting there. I remember interviewing Deborah Forte and saying, oh, so you mean parents can do this? And she said, well, no, not exactly. They can do this. They were linking basically an app to go with a Scholastic Book Fair so parents could see the books that were going to take, you know, going to be available, and they could read more information about it. They could get reviews. They could, you know, author information and stuff, and little activities to go with it. So they're getting there. And I'll say Scholastic usually does a really great job with building interactivity into all of its titles. You know, so they've got a lot of game books where there's, you know, the book series and then the online game to go with it and the app to go with it. And so they're really ahead of their time in terms of children's content and children's publishing. I think one of the biggest problems that we face here in the U.S. is that reading comes with such a negative connotation. Look at even our popular media. The kid who reads is a weirdo. The kid who writes stories in her journal at night when nobody can see her is a weirdo. We don't glorify reading in any way. We don't put any kind of cultural value on it. And then as an educational system, we suck the joy out of it. You know, we had this situation this summer where, I mean, these teachers, I could cry for these teachers who worked so hard in Florida to pick a book. It was the entire school was going to read this one book over the summer and come back ready to do all these cool activities on it. It was Little Brother by Cory Doctorow. And the principal pulled the plug on it for its inappropriate themes and profanity and all this stuff, despite the fact that the principal had not read it and those things were not in there. It was so wrong. I actually hoped it was all a big plot on the part of the adults to encourage the kids to read it. I'm really hoping the principal jumps up that first day of the school and screams, gotcha, made you read the book, you know, by telling you not to read it. It was that stupid. In 2014, that high school kids are told not to read a book by Cory Doctorow after these teachers work so hard developing, you know, activities to go with it and thematic units and things like that. And then we get these articles like the Wall Street Journal articles that have said kids don't need these, they need the classics, you know. Yeah, because Moby Dick is all that relevant today. I'm sorry, there are themes in Moby Dick that are great and, you know, universal and cross time and cultural barriers. It is, at the end of the day, a book that has 30 pages describing whale blubber. Okay, it's not for everybody. It's not for today's culture.
Apparently, Moby Dick is on the top 10 list of books that people start and never finish.
They make it to page 15 of the blubber description. And I say that with all authority as a high school English teacher for 16 years in my previous life. Basically, I've seen it. I've been handed books myself and told, you're going to teach this. This is the book your class is going to read. They're all going to read it. Ninth grade in my state, Romeo and Juliet, Great Expectations. And by golly, there's not time for anything else. So we try to bring in all these independent reading activities. And all that is, when you look at it, it's just more homework. If I say to you, everybody pick a book, read it, write a report, all I've done is given you more work to do. I haven't done anything to foster your love of reading. And then we come back around to the good books get pulled off the shelves. You're not allowed to read them. Sherman Alexie's book, Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, is not only a completely universal theme that could speak to kids in every single high school in America. Oh no, we can't talk about that one. We can't read that one because the kid refers to masturbation. There's not even a scene depicting it. He refers to it. And so basically I see the problem is parents are exercising their rights to have a right, and they're not actually reading these books. They're still up in arms about the ability to tell a school, you're not going to tell me what to do with my kid. And books are just, unfortunately, the shield in the way. They're the casualty of all this. And so we don't do anything to make reading awesome for kids. When we've had great testimony from people who've said YA books save their lives. I mean, we had the whole YA Saves campaign on Twitter with the hashtag. Ellen Hopkins got involved, and Cheryl Rainfield, and a bunch of other authors got involved and collected stories from people on life-changing books that basically saved their lives when they were kids. And Ellen Hopkins is one of the top ones where people write to her all the time and say, I was going to kill myself, but then I read your book. You know, and please tell me the last time Moby Dick did that for somebody, you know, we're just not finding that with Jane Eyre. I mean, I'm sorry. So, you know, it's great to have the classics and keep them available, but we're going to have to do something to make people excited to read a book again.
So is it safe to say that the Goldfinch would not be a part of your former English department's remedial reading program? I mean, they don't really talk about masturbation as much as they talk about excessive drug use, excessive right. sex, theft, murder.
See, actually, all of that would be great. And that's the problem. We remove all of that from the reading list. We want to pretend those things are not really happening. Goldfinch wouldn't be relevant, I think, to people I would have taught, just because it's about a painting. That wouldn't grab them. Something has to grab them and make them want to read it. And I love that scene in Shawshank Redemption where they're stuck in the library and he says to the kind of rockabilly guy, he's like, oh, you'll like it. It's about a prison break. Okay, come on. That was awesome. That was his description of The Count of Monte Cristo. That's how he got that guy to want to read the book. And the guy later tells him, I read that book you told me about, you know, and he says, I'll file it under educational, you know. I mean, so, and that's the thing. We have to hook people, not just children. We have to hook people. Look how many copies of A Cuckoo's Calling sold. The month it was released, it sold in the ballpark of 1,500 copies until the news broke that it was J.K. Rowling. Oh, my gosh. And then they ran out. They had to do another print run. You know, bookstores couldn't stock it.
Every single paper in the world talked exactly. about it.
Right, because she's a great writer. That was the only hook. That is all we needed. Forget the fact that Casual Vacancy had already happened to the world. That was all it took. People wanted to see what she did next because she's a great writer. And they didn't need a hook. They didn't need a detective novel or former veteran. They didn't need any of that setup. They needed to hear J.K. Rowling wrote this one, and they stood in line to get it because it grabbed them. And so, and we don't do a good enough job doing that for young people.
So the last few apps I want to mention is a company you're familiar with, Zooka, who's done mm-hmm. the iStoryTime app. They have a lot of licensed property. So if your kid watches a lot of Pixar or a lot of Disney, they have like Shrek, Madagascar, Kung Fu Panda, the Smurfs, you know, a lot of enhanced ebooks and things like that. So there's interactivity, there's read aloud features. So if you have like a wee tyke and you grew up with read-along records, this is sort of like the modern equivalent of it. And if you want to get your kid reading, you know, other content, maybe like magazines and things like that, Zinio has a program called ZPass, which is, you know, you select 3 or 4 magazines, you pay a few dollars a month, and then you get those magazines, every month at a very low cost. And there's also a 30-day promotion with Next Issue, which has been getting a lot of television commercials in Canada and the U.S. It's basically a Zinio competitor, but they have a free 30-day promotion. So that's like half of the summer that you could actually read everything in their entire catalog. Before we wrap up the show today, Mercy, do you have any final thoughts on any of the stories that we've talked about during the last week? Or anything that you read.
Right. We had a little bit of a breakthrough in understanding some of the dynamics happening in the Amazon Hachette dispute. I'm so tired of typing the words Amazon Hachette dispute. It's all run together as one term now. We've seen some of the other publishers weigh in. And they weren't directly discussing the problems that are happening there. Of course, Russ Grandinetti did speak out finally and very veiled. Yeah, but did get a quote to the Wall Street Journal about the fact that, you know, they claim we're doing this for our customers. We have promised our customers we will be the source for the best low price content, and we're not going to back down from that. And so basically, a lot of people, I think, misunderstand this dispute that is happening. They think Amazon's pushing publishers around and bullying people. But we saw Macmillan and Simon & Schuster filed some court papers because they've ended up kind of getting the shaft in the whole ebook lawsuit that took place with the Department of Justice and Apple, of course. They're not able to attempt to negotiate for agency pricing until now, it looks like 2017, where other publishers like Hachette will be able to. The terms on that, on the court ruling will expire this fall. And while Apple is still in appeal, that kind of delays things. But that's, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, that is a lot of what's behind Hachette's fight right now with Amazon, is they're gearing up to force Amazon back into agency pricing, where there will not be discounting allowed on their titles. So unfortunately, the judge's ruling stated that Apple is not allowed to enter into that agreement with any publisher until a set date, and then only with one publisher every 6 months. And so basically the end result will be Amazon will not be allowed to discount titles, and Apple will, since Apple is not allowed to enter into agency pricing. This is coinciding with the fall release of the iOS 8 update, which is going to bring iBookstore even more front and center for users.
And so, also don't forget new iPads, new iPhones, right. New computers.
Exactly. And so when the update comes along and the new devices come along, the iBookstore is going to be a bigger feature. It's going to be a lot more prominent and automatically linked to your iTunes account. So there's streamlined purchasing of titles that Apple will be legally bound to get to sell cheaper than Amazon. To me, that puts a different spin on things. I'm sorry. Like I said, I realize I'm the big Amazon champion, so I may come at this jaded, but that's, to me, that looks a little calculated, and I don't like it.
Well, I have like an iPad, an iPhone, and what I've noticed with Apple's bookstores, their prices are often a few dollars higher than Amazon.
Right. And see, that's, I see Apple keeping those prices and Amazon being forced into whatever the publisher tells them to charge. And so prices will go back up under this model. Again, that's my humble opinion. So simply based on watching this and seeing this news cross our desks every single day.
Yeah, I'm done with the Hachette Amazon news.
I can't let go of it.
I refuse to write a single... I've only written one piece on it, and I refuse to like talk about it in conversation. I refuse to write any articles. I refuse to talk about it on social media and Twitter. It's just like, if it wasn't about books, would anyone care?
Exactly. And I'll tell you though, I'm stopping people in the grocery store to tell them about it. But no, but
you know, that book that you just took from like the bookshelf, let me tell you a story about this.
Exactly. So, but truthfully, you are 100% right. And that tasted weird coming out of my mouth, is that you're right. Nobody would be talking about this if it was not Amazon. And I will say, first of all, where is the discussion of Amazon and the car battery suppliers? You know, where's the discussion of Amazon and the diaper companies? Nobody cares.
Or like the wine system that they set up where they could ship you wine, you know, $1,000 bottles of wine anywhere that in the world, you know? Okay. Nobody, if this wasn't about books,
right,
this would not be news. If it was about anything else, no one would care. So one final thing I want to talk to you about is piracy in regards to digital textbooks. And I've written a lot about lately about organized crime being involved in books, you know, industrial book scanning machines, and then reselling those books to students, bookstores, and actual colleges, universities, and private schools. Police in Seville and Madrid broke up a ring of 7 different locations that were manufacturing books. I think they seized about 1,000 physical books and about 10,000 ebooks that they were using to actually print up on their scanners. They arrested 3, but in Uganda, they had actually raided 28 different bookstores. And they had arrested a bunch of people, organized crime again, and they were saying that the street value of those books were roughly about $700,000 Canadian, and you got to figure in Uganda that money is more with their Ugandan shilling currency. But apparently in Uganda, piracy with books and textbooks accounts for $1.2 billion a year for their currency there. And What's happening is that they're not just selling them on Craigslist or eBay, but they're taking those pirate textbooks and going right to the bookstores and saying that, you know, we can give you a better deal than Pearson, or we can give you a better deal than McGraw-Hill, you know, at half the price. And then when students are saying, hey, you know, I turned to page 64 and the page is like upside down, you know, that sort of tipped them off that this was a big issue. So what do you think about, you know, textbooks obviously cost a lot of money, and, and you know, you got to look at all these countries that are being raided, you know, Spain, Uganda. It's not countries that traditionally where the average person is really well off. So people are trying to save money, but they're not knowing that they're actually buying pirated textbooks. So do you see this trend continuing?
I absolutely do. And I have to go back to a conversation I had in Frankfurt last year with Wesley Lynch, who's the CEO of South Africa-based Snaplify. That's an basically educational publishing is an area that Snaplify has a huge interest in. I remember reading this really interesting story about the murder rate and the criminal rate in the genealogy business. And I'm going, are you kidding me? What? You wouldn't think we have this underground mafia in the English literature textbook business or the calculus book business.
But you do.
We do. And that's the thing. Now, based on information that was accurate in the fall, last fall at Frankfurt Book Fair, I got to say that his take on the educational publishing situation throughout the continent in Africa was that they cannot get books any other way. We covered the awards, the Context Digital Innovation Awards at Frankfurt. It went to Paperwhite, which is a company that licenses ebooks to copy shops. So you walk up to the register and buy the book at the register, and the guy spits it out on a copy machine and you read it on three-hole punched paper. Because you cannot get books in the country. If you can get an ebook or a standard ebook, there's no bandwidth to read it or download it. And so piracy is rampant throughout the continent. And what Lynch was explaining was that even textbook publishers will not sell the books. If a school in Africa, a grade school, calls up, you know, a publisher and says, we need 20 more copies of the math book, they cannot have them. It's not worth the licensing. It's not worth the shipping. It's not worth setting up the vendor account because the school doesn't have the money to keep a massive textbook relationship going. And so at grade schools and local towns, even at universities, you walk up to the quote university bookstore, you pull the book you need off the shelf and you stand at a copy machine and copy it. And then you put that one copy of that book back up on the shelf. Well, when you create that situation, what did you think was going to happen? You know, piracy was going to happen. When parents are having to stand at a copy machine and copy and pay for a textbook, you know, a full-size calculus book because they want their child to have an education, what did you think was going to happen? You know, obviously, some guy is going to see a cash cow and walk up with 50 copies already made of this book and sell them at the bookstore for a markup. So he's profiting. He has no reason to quit what he's doing. The parents are happy because they didn't stand at a copy machine and do it themselves. And the school is happy because they're graduating students.
Apparently, you know, I mean, that, I agree with you. I mean, that sounds totally reasonable to me. But at the same point, the government is missing out on taxes. And that's
Oh, I agree. It's wrong.
That's the reason why they're, you know, shutting everything down. But do you think that shutting down these like organized crime-based piracy rings, do you think that ultimately that hurts the students, especially students like in Africa?
Absolutely. Because again, the point being, and I would have to wonder, again, humble opinion time talking, I have to wonder if this is not an effort on the part of some governments to stop education. We're seeing a lot of strife in a lot of these countries, a lot of civil war happening, still a lot of prejudice in some regions. And so that's where my mind first goes. Without any further knowledge on that, I fully admit, my mind first goes that the government doesn't want these books out there. And again, the situation was created by lack of access to books. And so I think there's several bad guys at work in this scenario. And the ones, again, who are going to suffer are the students who need books.
Yeah, like those 20 girl students that were like kidnapped for like ransom, or if you're caught watching the World Cup in like public in a lot of these places, it goes against like their religion, and right. you know, they'll send like people there to like shut it down / shoot the place up and things like right. that. So it's a totally different world. So, you know, right. we might say from like a first world point of view that, oh, piracy is so bad, you know, why are you pirating it when you could just go to like Amazon and buy it, or go to, you know, your bookstore and buy it? And then we forget that it's an entire different world in most of the world, where our values really don't hold much water. So you right. guys have been listening to the Goody Reader Radio Show. If you'd like to weigh in on anything that we've talked about, you can comment below using our commenting system on our website at goodyreader.com. And if you're listening to this show on TuneIn, SoundCloud, iTunes, and a myriad of other sources, visit the aforementioned website, and you could weigh in by clicking the radio button. So, Mercy, thanks for joining me today, and everybody, take care.